Collegium Regale. They bring to a close choral vespers. They were recorded at St Patrick's Roman Catholic Cathedral, Armagh, during this year's Charles Wood Summer School. The director of music was David Hill, the organ was played by Daniel Hyde, and the homily was given by His Eminence Cardinal Sean Brady, Archbishop of Armagh and Primate of All Ireland. It's 7:30 now. This is BBC Radio 3, and it's time to cross live to the Royal Albert Hall for our visit tonight to the BBC Proms. There, waiting for us, Penny Gore.
Well, returning to the stage of the Royal Albert Hall tonight for the second of their proms this season are the players of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, one of Europe's most famous and venerable ensembles. Chief conductor Ricardo Chailly is back with them to preside over two monumental works, Mahler's Symphony No. 6, which occupies all of the second half of the concert, and to begin Et Expecto Resurrectionem Mortuorum, a work by Olivier Messiaen, which calls for orchestral wind, brass, and a formidable battery of percussion. And the stage here is adorned with all manners of gongs, bells, and tam-tams. In fact, for all of us gathered here under the great dome of the Royal Albert Hall, we're arguably in the perfect place to hear the piece. It was intended, Messiaen said, for large spaces, churches, cathedrals, and even out of doors and among high mountains. Well, the work's sonorous title translates as I Await the Resurrection of the Dead. Messiaen was commissioned to write it in the 1960s by France's Minister of Cultural Affairs, André Malraux, who originally requested a requiem to commemorate the outbreak of World War II and to remember all those who died in the conflict. Well, Messiaen had himself been a member of the forces, a prisoner of war in Silesia in the 1940s, famously taking part in the first performance of his quartet for the End of Time in the camp in 1941. But despite his experiences, he refused to fall in with Malraux's suggestion. The new work, he said, was to be not a requiem, but an anticipation of the resurrection, a reaffirming of his own deeply held religious beliefs. The finished piece is in five movements, lasting about half an hour in total. Each section has a title, starting with a prayer. Out of the depths have I cried unto thee, O Lord. Echoed in the music with a sonorous theme rising from the lowest registers of the orchestra. Six notes forming a streak of lightning feature in the second movement, along with two other kinds of music. A trumpet chorale blending with ancient Indian rhythms played on the bells, and woodwinds seeming to pose and answer questions. In the third movement, Messiaen's beloved birdsong motifs appear. He quotes the call of an Amazonian bird, the Wirapuru, which is said to be heard at the moment of death, along with the Calandra lark, a symbol of celestial joy. The solemn moment of resurrection and the distant melody of the stars is evoked in the fourth section, with crashing tam-tams and gong leading to an Easter introit and alleluia. And the finale is a celebration of those resurrected as they ascend to paradise to the accompaniment of a closing chorale. Coming on stage now to join these members of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, Ricardo Chailly, to conduct Messiaen's Et Expecto Resurrectionem Mortuorum.
Thank you. Thank you.
Olivier Messiaen's Et Expecto Resurrectionem Mortuorum. I await the resurrection of the dead. Performed here at the Proms by members of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, conducted by Ricardo Chailly. It seemed to me, said Messiaen, that the nobility of the subject required this majestic and powerful orchestration. As I said before, the piece was intended for performance in large spaces, either sacred or secular. The first performance was given privately to an invited audience in Paris, in the Sainte-Chapelle, which with its soaring architecture and blaze of stained glass was very much to Messiaen's approval. It's actually been performed 9 times here at the Proms, which I guess is an indication of just how well this enormous space is suited to the music's quite unusual sonorities. And here's Ricardo Chailly coming back on stage now and asking members of this orchestra to stand and take solo bows, urging them towards the end of the piece to give more and more and more for that fantastic conclusion. And I guess it must be a work that has one of the widest dynamic ranges you're ever likely to hear. From the tiny, tiny whisper of the gongs at one point, just barely touched, to the whole of the ensemble at full stretch. Members of the brass taking their solo bow now. And all the members of the percussion section, 6 of them in total. Oh, now that is for the gong. 2 gongs, in fact. And the whole of this ensemble rising now. Ricardo Chailly, hand on heart as he bows to the audience, and incredibly attentive assemblage of Prommers here tonight crammed into the arena and eager to hear the second part of this concert, in which the stage will be pretty well jam-packed as the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra play Mahler's Symphony No. 6, which he originally dubbed the Tragic Symphony. And that'll start in 20 minutes or so. But it's time now for the last in our interval mini-series, Lucy Worsley's Kensington, in which Dr. Lucy Worsley has been finding interesting and quirky items of historical interest in the area surrounding the Royal Albert Hall. Now this evening we find her at one of London's best-kept secrets, the home of Punch cartoonist Edward Linley Sanborn, who lived at 18 Stafford Terrace, just off Kensington High Street.
That's the dinner gong in the hall of a house in Kensington called 18 Stafford Terrace. I'm with its senior curator, Daniel Robbins. And this has got to be the most perfect and complete Victorian house in London, wouldn't you say?
It is. It somehow managed to retain so much of its original fixtures, fittings, decorative schemes that it gives an incredibly immediate and evocative sense of what it must have been like to walk into a Victorian middle-class terraced house.
Rich and gloomy come to mind as adjectives.
It is. It's certainly that, and it has a huge number of objects in it displayed through these interiors.
It was an interesting man who lived here as well, Linley Sanborn. He was a cartoonist for the magazine Punch. And how many times great is he the grandfather of Viscount Linley?
He's his great-great-grandfather.
Tell me a bit more about his work as an artist. Is artist a too grand a name for a cartoonist?
Well, he, certainly in his early career, he wanted to be taken seriously as an artist, and he consorted with the artists in Melbury Road and Holland Park Road and their grand houses. And he did exhibit his illustrations at the Royal Academy, and he had a number of exhibitions later on in his career of his work. But what he particularly discovered was how he could use photography as a kind of shortcut to producing his weekly cartoon for Punch. And his weekly cartoon for Punch was a bit of a millstone round his neck. He always had to be in London, and it had to be here to produce that cartoon. and realised that if he used photography to create the cartoon, a tableau, which he could then trace the image and create a cartoon, that would be a kind of more interesting way of doing it.
Well, I want to talk more about his photography and all that, but I want to do it in the bathroom.
Where else?
So Daniel's just putting the blind up in the bathroom. Now, this might seem like a funny place to come to talk about the work of a cartoonist, but explain all. This is a really significant place for his work, isn't it?
It is. It's another fascination of the house. It's how he combined domestic use with his working life as an artist. And his particular application of the bathroom was to use it as a place where he developed his photographs. He used this process of making cyanotypes, these blue prints, and he would develop them in his bath. And so the bath is fitted with a little hinged shelf.
A special shelf that comes out like this.
So he could presumably put his developing fluids, developing tray on the shelf.
He takes a picture of a real person, wife, servant, maid, whoever, in the pose that he wants to use in that week's cartoon. And then he traces it. This is cheating, isn't it? Or is it quite a clever way of getting accurate human figures?
Yeah, I think it was, probably a mixture of both. I think it was a quicker, more rapid process. And I think there is definitely a sort of theatrical side to him. And he loved the idea of creating these little tableaus, of dressing himself up or dressing others up and posing them in the backyard of the house.
So all over the walls of the bathroom on this side, we've got lots and lots of photos. And these are just hilarious because he's doing all sorts of crazy things. And he's dressed himself up as, the king, a medieval knight who's been killed, a Roman emperor. And all of these were working towards a finished cartoon of someone.
They were. And the great thing is he was very meticulous in dating them. And so you can, on the back of them is the date on which he took them, which can be cross-referred to his diary. And so that will then reveal where he got the costume from, who was posing for him. We know on one day his mother was the Pope and Queen Victoria in the same day.
Pope and Queen Victoria in the same day, that he got his mum to do that. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Now, Daniel, I can't help but noticing that on the other side here, we've got lots more photos of Lily Sanborn, but the lady's all naked. What's going on here?
That's another side to his photographic interests. He was a member of the camera club, and that is where he would go to take these artistic nude shots. And we know that he engaged, as it were, proper models, professional models who were modelling for artists like Leighton, Millais, and that gave it some sort of stamp of genuine artistic
pursuit. Is this art?
Well, I could show you some that you would certainly have to ask that question, but they can't be displayed for our general public.
Did you recognise any of the ladies? Are they the housemaid or anybody?
No, they're all paid professional models. There is one instance where he photographed the maid asleep in her bed, although at least the maid is looking like she's asleep. Whether she thought that was just the safest bet was to pretend she's asleep. But again, his diary reveals he gets up especially early in order to take this photograph of her.
So it's a really interesting job description for the servants here. Half of the time they're cooking and cleaning. The other half of the time they're getting dressed up as Roman emperors or whatever. And then he's creeping around taking pictures of them asleep in bed.
That's right. Well, it could never be described as dull as a...
Dr. Lucy Worsley in a rather interesting bathroom. And if you'd like to visit Linley Sanborn House at 18 Stafford Terrace, you'll be pleased to hear that it reopens after conservation work next Saturday. That's the 8th of September. Now back here at the Radio 3 Loggia Box in the Royal Albert Hall, I'm joined by my Sunday night guest, the mathematician Marcus du Sautoy. Marcus, welcome.
Thank you.
How was that first half for you? Because you were saying a minute ago that you haven't actually heard that Messiaen piece live before.
I haven't heard it live, and just on recordings. I'm a massive Messiaen fan. Being a mathematician, Messiaen is, he's a secret mathematician, I think, because there's so much structure going on in his work, and especially that piece there. I mean, he... He's a great fan of sort of mathematical structures, and this is all about the chords, I think, the colour chords that he uses in that piece.
Yes, there's a lot of symmetry going on. I mean, I speak as a non-mathematician, but I'm sure you'll make it easy for me. But lots of patterns and repeating
elements.
Yeah,
and little sort of combinatorial games, because he used to he constructed different scales, not the usual sort of major minor that we're kind of used to in classical Western music, but scales which had particular mathematical properties, and that's what he constructed the chords, these colour chords that he used in that piece. So it's the other thing he loved is rhythm, and I think that this piece is more not so much about rhythm, but more about that sort of I suppose vertical structure rather than horizontal structure that he's going for.
Absolutely, and I was saying earlier the way the sound varies from the tiniest whisper to an extraordinary voice, and in fact it's a real sort of hairs on the back of the neck at times.
Absolutely, and I think it's something you can't. I mean, I've heard many recordings of this, but this is the first time I've heard it live, and I think you really can't experience on a recording that sense of the space of the piece. I mean, actually the silence is as important as the huge sounds as well. I mean, that was quite intriguing, sitting there seeing the conductor conduct the silence. I mean, equally important.
Exactly, yes. I mean, he was obviously making a very big point of that at times,
yes,
wasn't
absolutely.
He was waiting until the right moment. And also, you must have been intrigued by the brass in that, because
yeah.
You are a brass player.
I'm a trumpeter, so I love Messiaen because he writes such good trumpet parts, and that had, you know, there's a piccolo trumpet in there, and it's, you know, that is really a piece for somebody who loves their brass.
There is an amazing range of brass in there, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. But I actually had the chance when I was playing in my youth orchestra to play some Messiaen, which is when I first fell in love with him, which was the Tarangalila, which also, I think that was the day my trumpet playing was at its best. I actually, you know, I hit every note.
You rose to the occasion.
Yeah, it was really, really fantastic. That's when I fell in love with him.
Well, you've been getting more involved with music, we know, outside your day job, because you took part in Maestro at the Opera fairly recently, and you got pretty far in there. How was that?
I mean,
was it a terrifying experience?
Terrifying and an amazing experience. It's intriguing because as a trumpeter in an orchestra, I've always been a little bit down on conductors. You know, I say, well, it's us who's actually playing the music. You know, what are they doing? They're just flapping their hands around. So I really learned actually how much a conductor plays such a significant role in actually bringing alive a piece and that interpretation. I mean, yeah, the Messiaen wrote the notes and the players are playing the notes off the page, but actually, you know, it's very significant what the conductor is doing. I think I learned that for the first time, and also just the joy of spending time with the score and actually seeing how these pieces are put together was an utter privilege.
And there's a theatricality about it as well, even more so, obviously, if it's to do with the opera. But the whole role of the conductor as a sort of theatrical figure is very important.
Yes, I mean, you're actually a sort of, you know, you're not actually making any noise, but the movement of your body is actually bringing, you know, each of those chords in that last movement alive. You could see the energy coursing through the conductor and that being communicated to the players. And so they knew what he wanted out of each of those chords as they built up to that extraordinary climax.
And has it made you want to go on and do more conducting?
I've got my first gig since Maestro coming up this Friday, which is really exciting. I mean, I really did enjoy the experience. So I'm actually playing with the Bristol Ensemble it's a part of an art project for the Cultural Olympiad called Nowhere Island. It's a piece of island which has been taken from Norway and is floating all the way around the south coast of England. It's ending up at Bristol.
Let's get this straight. Is it an actual piece of island?
It's an actual piece of island that the Norwegian government donated to Alex Hartley, who's the artist in charge of this project. And it's basically a nation. And you can sign up to become a citizen. It's got 20,000 citizens at the moment. I was one of its resident thinkers, and they asked me, would I like to be their maestro? So, in fact, I'm the island's conductor, which is really fun. And I'm doing my first concert on this coming Friday.
And what's it involved? Do you know what?
Well, we're still actually putting together the programme. So there's going to be a Norwegian theme. So I think a bit of Grieg and Holberg suite, and maybe a sea theme as well. Although I'm a bit terrified because, you know, conducting La Mer for on the day, I think, would probably be a bit beyond me.
And how does that all fit in with your day job? When you're listening to music, do you find yourself looking for mathematical patterns.
Yes, I do. I think there's a massive connection, actually, because both are really about abstract structures. So when you're listening to a piece of Messiaen and trying to find your way around it, or even the Mahler, for example, or Mozart, you're actually listening to patterns and seeing how patterns repeat or change and connect to the things you've heard before. That's really what I'm doing as a mathematician as well. So I listen to a lot of music whilst I'm doing my mathematics because I feel the two sort of stimulate each other.
Well, we're going to get you to look ahead to the final few days of the proms, and you've chosen a piece of music for us from a prom that's yet to come. What is it, and why have you chosen it?
Well, I've chosen the Bruckner 9, which is on Thursday night, mainly because Bruckner writes also such fantastic trumpet parts. And I fell in love with Bruckner when I was first heard it at school, and in particular the Bruckner 9. So, and also the beginning of that concert is Murray Pariah, so you can't go wrong with a combination like that.
Well, Marcus du Sautoy, thank you so much for coming and sitting in the Radio 3 Loja box, squeezing your way in. I'm going to let you get back to your seat for the second half, and we're going to hear your choice of music. It's the opening of Bruckner's Symphony No. 9. Thank you. The opening of Bruckner's Symphony No. 9 in D minor, a favourite piece of my guest and fellow prommer, Marcus du Sautoy, played there by the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, conducted by Bernhard Haitink. And he will conduct that piece on Thursday with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. That's in Prom 73. Now, though, let's cross the Atlantic to hear from members of another visiting orchestra heading for the Royal Albert Hall this year, the St. Louis Symphony.
I'm Celeste Golden-Boyer, and I play the violin in the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra.
My name is Thomas Jostlein. I'm the associate principal horn player.
The St. Louis Symphony Orchestra was founded in 1880, so it's the second oldest symphony orchestra in the United States. We play in the Powell Symphony Hall here in St. Louis, which was originally a vaudeville or a movie theater, recreated to be one of the world-class halls that we have here in our country. The other really special thing about our orchestra is the kind of family relationship we have with one another. It's just a band of really kind, wonderful people, and we like each other, we enjoy spending time together, and we certainly enjoy getting to make music with one another.
This is my sixth orchestra I've been a member of. I've played everywhere from Hawaii to the New York Philharmonic. It's a very friendly orchestra, and there's a sense of expression that's encouraged here that I've not found everywhere else. There's a sense of encouragement of really saying something musically when you play. St. Louis is a city of history. We have Scott Joplin, the ragtime composer, was born here. Mark Twain lived here and was born very close by in Hannibal, Missouri. There's some beautiful old buildings here, but also a real patchwork of ethnic neighborhoods, the Italian section, the Polish section. There's this enormous old brewery downtown. The Budweiser Brewery is here in St. Louis as well, so it's a city of beer.
It has kind of a small town feel. It's kind of a foodie town. We have lots of really good restaurants, lots of independent owners, not lots of chains. There's lots of culture in this town. There's theaters. We have incredible opera during the summer and art museums and beautiful parks, and it's a beautiful place to live.
And you can hear the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra playing at the Proms next Tuesday evening under their music director, David Robertson, with a programme of Brahms, Schoenberg, Gershwin and Beethoven's Violin Concerto with Christian Tetzlaff. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. And as I said earlier, the audience here absolutely crammed in tonight awaiting the rest of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra's Prom. Don't forget that you can tweet as well and sample a selection of favourite moments from the last 7 days of Prom's concerts that Prommers here have been tweeting about. Visit the Radio 3 homepage and click on your Prom's highlights. And if you'd like to tweet your favourite Prom moment along with the Prom number, just, for example, go to hashtag Prom26 or add a post to the BBC Prom's Facebook page. Well, applause now for the players of the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra as they start to make their way back on stage, making ready for the second half of tonight's Prom, live here on BBC Radio 3 and online in high-definition sound. Ricardo Chailly will be rejoining them for a performance of Mahler's Symphony No. 6. And as I mentioned earlier, very considerably bigger ensemble for this piece than from the Messiaen that we heard in the first half of the concert. Well, the symphony was written over the course of a year or so in 1903 and 1904, a relatively happy period in the composer's life. He and his wife Alma were expecting their second child, and his work as director of the Vienna Court Opera was attracting critical approval, although with a certain amount of behind-the-scenes tension, perhaps an inevitable side effect of his determination to introduce new repertoire. It was against that background that Mahler sat down to start work on his new symphony and ended up writing what's arguably his darkest and most sombre music. Not for nothing did he nickname it the Tragic Symphony, although that title had disappeared by the time the premiere took place. It scored, as I said, for large orchestra with plentiful on- and off-stage percussion, including two instruments appearing for the first time in Mahler's music, a celesta and a hammer, which plays an important role. More about that later. Now, there's been much debate ever since the work's premiere about the order of its two middle movements. Mahler changed his mind about it more than once, and so has Riccardo Chailly.
Well, we know that Mahler tried Scherzo first and Dante second, but then changed mind. And I've been also doing the same thing in my experience with this piece, which I always felt somehow unsatisfied. And I discovered that separating thoroughly first movement to the Scherzo, placing the Andante in the middle, you force the shape of the construction of the Scherzo to be much more distant from the character of the sort of imposing march of the first movement. That gave me an idea completely different from the time when I recorded, because when I recorded I was extremely young in Amsterdam in the early 80s, to choose a complete different set of tempo in the Scherzo. Normally you hear the first movement in one tempo and the Scherzo start exactly the same metronome, although there is no metronome indication in the score. And I decided that this would not please me enough to make more of a diabolic dance with death, as it is, with a beautiful trio in the middle, a little bit old-fashioned style. But the general driving character of the Scherzo for me has to have a much higher degree of speed compared to the first movement. And this idea came because of the separation with the Andante in the middle, which is one of the greatest song without words, which was a typical example of an endless melody, a melody without an end,